One of the key reasons vision motivates is because it often encapsulates high ideals and convictions. Another reason it is so motivating is because it provides direction, which is the next point. Vision gives direction. Vision is how you know where you are going. Thus, vision provides a context to your decision-making and an overall direction to your life. Speaking about companies, but the same concepts transfer to our personal lives, Collins rightly says, "The importance of vision cannot be overemphasized. A shared vision is like having a compass and distant destination in the mountains. If you give a group of people a compass and destination point, and then turn them loose in the mountains to reach that destination, they will probably figure out a way to get there. They may encounter obstacles, detours, bad turns, and side canyons along the way. However, with the general directions of the compass, a clear end goal, and the belief that they are working towards a worthy destination, they will probably reach the target." God is a God of vision. The need for a vision for our lives is rooted in the nature of God, for God is a God of vision. He is always casting pictures of the future, of where we are headed and are to be headed. And he is a God who calls and sends, which is a type of vision. God casts vision. We see God casting vision everywhere, and vision is especially concentrated in the prophets. The book of Isaiah is full of pictures of the future and high ideals that God puts before us. The minor prophets, such as Haggai, Nahum, and Micah, are filled with pictures of where God is taking his people. And in the New Testament, we see Jesus giving a vision to the apostles, to Paul, and to the entire church. God sends. God is also a sending God. Sending has to do with purpose, and therefore, vision. God sent Joseph into Egypt to deliver his people from famine. Genesis 45 verse 5 and chapter 50 verse 20. Psalm 105 verses 17 through 19. He sent Moses to deliver Israel from Egypt. Acts 7 verses 32 through 34. He sent Isaiah. Isaiah 6 verse 8. Jeremiah. Jeremiah 1 verses 5 through 9. And the prophets. Jeremiah 7 verses 25 through 28. He sent Jesus. Galatians 4 verse 4. He sent Paul on his mission to the Gentiles. Acts 26 verses 16 through 18. He sent the disciples. Matthew 28 verses 18 through 20 and John 20 verse 21. And he sends all of us. John 17 verse 18. God is a sending God, and that means he is a God of mission and vision. Summarizing how vision helps you get unstuck. Now we can see that you simply can't get unstuck if you can't create vision. Developing a vision for your life is fundamental in helping you get unstuck, for it provides four things. 1. Direction. A vision defines where you want to go, and if you have no destination, then you are by definition stuck. 2. Power. A vision provides the power to get you to your destination because it generates passion, motivation, and commitment. Motivation is the power you need to get going and keep going. So, direction and power are both necessary. Direction without motivation might make the destination clear, but it won't get you going down the path. Likewise, sometimes you just need more power to get out of the mud. 3. Focus. Having a vision helps you stay focused, avoiding detours to nowhere because you can see more clearly what truly needs to be done and what doesn't. A vision gives you a mental model of how you expect things to proceed, and as Charles Duhigg writes in Smarter, Faster, Better, when you have such a mental model, then, when distractions inevitably arise, it's easier to decide in the moment whether they deserve your focus or can be ignored. 4. Unity. A vision enables you to work together with others because shared vision unifies action. And further, vision provides all of these things from the fundamental level. That is, refining your vision is fundamental change, because vision goes to the roots rather than simply being superficial, surface-level behavior modification. Vision goes to the roots of our actions by getting to our core beliefs and affections, and so changes us from the bottom up. And so it gets us unstuck at the fundamental and therefore truly lasting level. The Unstuck Clinic. Core point. Vision is essential to providing the motivation and direction to get unstuck. It ignites passion, connects to purpose and meaning, creates motivation, gives direction so that the energy of motivation goes to the right place, and enables you to prioritize and cut things out along the way so that you avoid detours to nowhere. Exercise. Reflect on a time in your life when you've experienced the power of vision. What is your vision for your life? Jot down a few initial ideas in preparation for the next chapter. Chapter 8. Be missional. Understand how your faith and work relate. From having a mission to being missional, how Christianity and culture relate, and the central role of our work. Skeptics need more than an argument in order to believe. They need to observe intelligent, admirable fellow human beings and see that a big part of what makes them this way is their faith. Tim Keller. As Christians, we have an extraordinary mission. It is motivating, all-encompassing, and meaningful. It is to participate with God in His work to renew all things, working as agents of His love in all areas of life. Yet, we are stuck in our mission in many ways because we have not fully understood how our faith is to relate to the culture. Central to getting unstuck here is getting clearer on that. That is, we need a strategy. That strategy is being missional. Much has been written on this topic, but let me summarize a few core points to help us get unstuck and then point to some resources, such as Tim Keller's excellent book, Center Church, Doing Balanced, Gospel-Centered Ministry in Your City. Should we seek to change the world? First, we need to ask, should we seek to change the world at all? Being productive as a Christian is ultimately about doing good for others, and we should seek to do good for others and society in the greatest possible sense. Changing the structures of society so that it is organized in a way that supports the doing of good and advancement of God's purposes more naturally and fully, instead of opposing His purposes. The extent to which we can transform culture in this strong sense is debatable. But we can all agree that we are called to transform the culture at the very least in the sense of making a positive difference. Through our collective efforts, we want to see a difference made for the good of others on a large scale in society. That is culture change. Whether we can do that to a high degree or just a better degree than we are doing now can be debated. The issue is simply that we do need to work together to improve our society. Why we need to be missional? To change the world, we need a strategy that is appropriate, good, and in line with our values as Christians. Being missional is that strategy, and it is vital for two reasons. First, it is how we impact and renew the culture. By doing our work in a gospel-centered way, we create culture and impact culture in a way that benefits others, and thus brings renewal. Second, being missional is crucial for people to come to faith. Years ago, attending church was commonplace, and we could assume that most people were hearing the gospel message. Now that is not the case, and we need to make greater efforts to go to the people, which is at the heart of being missional. And we need to do it through our ordinary vocations, and in a way that winsomely and accurately reflects God's character. Keller puts it well. Skeptics need more than an argument in order to believe. They need to observe intelligent, admirable fellow human beings and see that a big part of what makes them this way is their faith. What does it mean to be missional? Now, what does it mean to be missional? For our call is not only to be evangelistic, but missional as well. Outwardly focused. To be missional means being the kind of outwardly focused Christian that is necessary now that our society has become post-Christian. It means going into the culture to reach people, not making ourselves distinct through Christian trinkets and tactless presentations of the gospel, but through love, serving others. We are to be a contrast to mainstream society, but in the right way. We are to be a counterculture for the common good, always looking for opportunities to tactfully and appropriately bring up the gospel. Contextualizing. Being missional includes being intentional about reaching the culture. That is, you study the culture to identify how to serve it best and how to communicate best, much like an overseas missionary would do in a new mission field. You adapt to the culture in all ways that Scripture allows, while remaining fully faithful to the unchanging truth of God's Word. You contextualize the gospel through word and deed so that it can be best understood by the culture without compromising the gospel. This is exactly what Paul did. For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became as a Jew, in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings. 1 Corinthians 9, verses 19 through 23. Holistic. Being missional is a comprehensive approach to life. We do everything we do as a conscious participation with God to fulfill His purposes in the world, as Christopher Wright says in The Mission of God's People. As we saw earlier, this can lead to the temptation to think that only evangelism matters. But since God is renewing all of creation and making new heavens and a new earth, a holistic doctrine of work is key to being missional. Thus, being missional means thinking deeply about how to use our work and vocation to advance the common good. So we have to know better how to be public about our faith, in tactful, winsome ways that are not high pressure or off-putting. You don't have to work in a church. Being missional means that you don't have to be a professional church worker to fully follow Christ. You certainly can do that, but you can follow Christ fully in any job or life circumstance, because work matters in itself, and is a platform for advancing the gospel when done in love, and with appropriate attention to evangelistic opportunities. Everything we do, secular work as well as church work, thus becomes infused with a special dynamism and significance, which is, in fact, the doctrine of vocation. Working according to Christian values is key for changing the world. Our work is central to changing the world and renewing the culture. This is something the church lost over the last 100 years, but is regaining. Hugh Welchel writes, "The most overlooked reason for the failure of the church to influence the culture is the loss of the biblical doctrine of work." Our professional callings are inextricably linked with our impact on the culture, for they are the chief way we interact with the culture and create culture. But it's not just any kind of work that changes the world. It is gospel-centered work that changes the world. Going even beyond excellence, gospel-centered work is done as worship to God and out of love for others. It is done with a generosity of spirit that truly puts others first by our thinking hard about how to serve their needs and then doing that rather than cutting corners. So, living according to Christian values such as love and generosity in the workplace is central to gospel advancement and changing the world. How does our work change the world? Our work changes the world in at least two ways. First, it is through our work that we change the structures of society, and it is by changing the structures of society that we change the world, as James Davison Hunter argues in To Change the World. Simply doing your work accomplishes this change, and managers and leaders who have the authority to set policy can make change to a very influential degree. They can influence the structures of their company and organization in people-centered ways. This doesn't mean imposing Christianity, but rather designing policies around the value of people, which business research is now showing many organizations have overlooked, but which actually leads to the greatest effectiveness. Simon Sinek, for example, writes, "Studies show that over 80% of Americans do not have their dream job. If more knew how to build organizations that inspire, we could live in a world in which that statistic was the reverse. A world in which over 80% of people love their jobs. People who love going to work are more productive and more creative. They go home happier and have happier families. They treat their colleagues and clients and customers better. Inspired employees make for stronger companies and stronger economies." So, if you have a place in shaping the policies of your organization, make them reflect generosity and the value of people. Turn your organization into one that does not hinder people from doing their best work and fully advancing the mission, but fully enables them to do it. Part of being missional is building organizations where people flourish. Second, our work changes the world because through our work, we are able to join with networks of leaders from all over, which is central to how culture actually changes. James Davison Hunter makes this argument in To Change the World. He also points out that the reason why Christians are not having an impact on the culture that is proportional to their numbers is because we are mostly absent from the centers of power where culture is forged. He writes, "Cultures are shaped when networks of leaders, representing the different social institutions of a culture, work together towards a common goal. Again and again, we see that the impetus, energy, and direction for changing the world were found where cultural, economic, and often political resources overlapped, where networks of elites who generated these various resources came together in common purpose." And so why aren't Christians influencing culture more? Hunter continues, "Because they have been absent from the areas in which the greatest influence in the culture is exerted. The cultural producing institutions of historical Christianity are largely marginalized in the economy of culture formation in North America. Its cultural capital is greatest where leverage in the larger culture is weakest. We can be more present in those areas if we re-embrace the biblical doctrine of work. It isn't chiefly evangelism or politics or social reform movements that change the world, but people working in their vocations. Thus, we need to be in the centers of cultural production, the cities." And so, as Tim Keller and James Hunter write, "Christians cannot simply rest satisfied with individual conversions or separated enclaves when they discern the central plot line of the Bible. Since the whole world broke and God is renewing the whole world, we do have a role to play in transforming culture. God's purpose is not only saved individuals, but also a new world based on justice, peace, and love, rather than power, strife, and selfishness. And our work, done according to real Christian values in a gospel-centered way, is part of how that happens. Our work is part of God's ongoing work to bring everything to a higher state of goodness," says T.M. Moore. "And so, God intends your work to contribute to the restoration of the creation, and the people in it, to raising life on this blue planet to higher states of beauty, goodness, and truth, reflecting the glory of God in our midst. We will only fully appreciate the value and potential of our work when we see it in that light. The bottom line is that we must recognize the broad concept of our mission as Christians, not only to do evangelism, but also to serve the common good and create culture. Ironically, this broader concept of our mission actually serves the cause of evangelism better. John Stott sums it up best. If we accept this broader concept of mission as Christian service in the world, comprising both evangelism and social action, a concept which is laid upon us by the model of our Savior's mission in the world, then Christians could, under God, make a far greater impact on society, an impact commensurate with our numerical strength and with the radical demands of the commission of Christ. The Unstuck Clinic. Core point. We are called to impact the culture as Christians. If we are to do so, we must learn to be missional, how to understand and relate tactfully with the culture without compromising the gospel. Exercise. In what ways does your work influence culture? Does the way you interact with coworkers create a good reflection of the gospel? What character traits of Christ can you reflect more fully in your work and community? Chapter 9. See yourself as a professional. Sort of. Gaining the skill to keep getting consistent great results, over and over, with an ethic of generosity and service. Being a professional is doing the things you love to do, on the days you don't feel like doing them. Julius Irving. Getting unstuck is not just about getting unstuck. It's about staying unstuck as well. You consistently have to get things done, done well, and with continual improvement. That's what it means to be a professional. And being a professional is essential to being unstuck. What being a professional means. Consider things you do for fun or as a hobby. You do those things when you feel like it. If you don't feel like going boating, for example, you aren't going to do it. With your work, it has to be different. Certainly, you should enjoy your work, but you can't just do your work when you feel like it. You have to do it even when you don't feel like it, and still perform well. That's what it means to be a professional. You show up every day and deliver, regardless of how you feel. As Stephen Pressfield has put it so well, a professional is someone who can keep working at a high level of effort and ethics, no matter what is going on, for good or ill, around him or inside him. As a professional, you show up every day. You play hurt. More than this, you don't just do your work even when you don't feel like it. You consistently deliver results. You can be relied on to deliver consistent, excellent results. Delivering that great project is an awesome thing. But to truly be unstuck means that you are able to keep doing that over and over again. It's the difference between a musician who is a one-hit wonder and one who has an established, successful career. Your goal is not to do one great project and then fizzle out. Your goal is to deliver consistent results over time, again and again. Being a professional is about creating a career out of your ability. You produce a shelf of books with your name on them, or a portfolio of awesome website designs, or great code, or consistent revenue growth in your organization. Such consistency seems like it should be easy. If you can do something once, you can do it again, right? I thought it would be easy, but for some reason, to be discussed shortly, it's often not. What fights against your professionalism? Being a professional can be hard for three main reasons. Lack of preparation. One reason that being a professional is hard is that we just don't have the skills. Sometimes we have the desire to do something and maybe a bit of natural ability, but when we step out and try to do it, we realize it takes much more skill beyond our natural ability. For example, one of the very first speaking engagements I had in college went great. It was a huge hit. I spoke on the historical evidence for the resurrection of Christ, and my message got through to the audience. The organizer loved it so much, she invited me to speak at her camp that summer. When I was getting ready for the message at the camp a few months later, I thought to myself, well, I can't say the same things I did in the previous message. I'd better find something new. Now, this was a classic mistake, for although I had an entirely different audience, I felt I had to say something very different. But, of course, the different things I had to say meant leaving out the points I had made in the previous message that had made the big impact. The message did not go well. What was my lack of skill here? Not necessarily in delivery, nor even in the understanding of the subject. Part of it was my lack of preparation for that message. I didn't spend a lot of time preparing. I thought I could wing it. My lack of skill stemmed primarily from a deeper lack of preparation, not understanding the skill of speaking itself. I made a tactical mistake of thinking I had to say something new and different every time I spoke, not realizing that this new audience would benefit if I said the same thing as before. Further, I should have realized that a lot of times people want to hear the same thing. You don't go to a concert and expect your favorite artist to avoid playing your favorite song. We will talk about preparation in chapter 10. No guiding theme. You will notice that most of the best authors or recording artists have a certain theme that centers their work. With John Piper, it's Christian hedonism and the glory of God. With John Maxwell, it's leadership. With Bill Hybels, it's winsomely pointing unbelievers to Christ. With Tim Keller, it's gospel-centeredness. These men say new things, but things coming from the same center. Rather than making things overly simple, this strategy actually creates a depth that leads people to keep wanting to hear more. Because the central theme makes sense of things, what speakers say becomes more helpful, and the listeners know what to expect. Resistance. Resistance is the third and strongest thing that can make professionalism hard. Stephen Pressfield focuses on resistance in his work on being a professional in The War of Art. He defines it as that self-created and self-perpetuated, invisible, impersonal, indefatigable force whose sole aim is to prevent us from doing our work, from becoming our best selves, and from rising to the next level of competence, integrity, and generosity. Resistance rears its head every time you want to do something important. It takes the form of writer's block, procrastination, diversion from your task, or inability to execute. It doesn't come from laziness or bad intentions. That's why it's so tricky and powerful. Pressfield argues that it ultimately comes from fear. It is almost part of ourselves working against us, perhaps out of fear of success, because success brings change. It's hard to know exactly what causes resistance. Is it really fear of success? I don't know for sure. What I do know is that everyone who seeks to create encounters it in one way or another. How do you develop the capacity to consistently produce? How do you fight resistance? For a full treatment, I recommend Pressfield's classic, The War of Art. I love that title. He captures right away that doing great work is a battle. While there is much we can do, here is a simple process that Pressfield suggests, which I think is perhaps the most effective and promising approach. He recommends this. Stage 1, being able to work for a single hour. Stage 2, being able to do it again. Stage 3, being able to finish. You just repeat these steps over and over again, forcing yourself if necessary. Yes, use tactics and strategies, including the ones I recommend throughout this book. But success all comes down to these three steps. the bad sense of professional. Now, some who see the title of this chapter might take pause. Being a professional, of course, is generally considered a good thing. But authors like John Piper have shown that it can also be a bad thing, especially in ministry. In fact, he wrote an entire book on pastoral ministry called Brothers, We Are Not Professionals. Is what I'm saying contrary to Piper's message? Would what I'm saying here kill the ministry if pastors took it seriously? What we need to see is that there are two senses of the word professional, a good sense and a bad sense. The good sense is what we've just seen. You show up every day and you deliver regardless of how you feel. Piper would certainly agree with that definition of professional. He embodies it almost more than anyone else. He delivers day after day what he is called to do. For 33 years, he preached every weekend. Now, he is teaching on desiringgod.org through Bible study labs, articles, and messages. He consistently delivers excellent content. What Piper is critiquing is the bad sense of the term professional. This is the professionalism that is associated with a detachment, an inauthenticity, and a lack of interaction, conversation, and real community. These things characterize persons who don't get emotionally involved in their work because they are professionals and their work is just about business. They omit emotions and true caring from their work. They are like the HR consultant I once worked with who never smiled because he wanted to be professional and keep the right power distance. That is not what I mean by being a professional. Further, the best business thinkers today also reject being a professional in this sense. People like Seth Godin and Tim Sanders argue that being emotionally engaged and caring about our work and the people we do the work for is at the heart of doing great work and the driver of true excellence. Even more, it's what people want from us. They don't want emotional detachment. That fails to treat ourselves and others as fully human. It's a segmented, truncated view of humanity. In A Sense of Mission, Andrew Campbell and Laura Nash well summarize the common view of detached professionalism, pointing out that some question the benefit of creating passionate employees and managers. They write, "It can be argued that business needs calm, rational, clear-headed managers who can be dispassionate and caring about their companies. Managers who fall in love with their business are dangerous. Moreover, in larger organizations, these passionate managers can create divisiveness and cultural conflict that hinder smooth operating." But their research disproves this view. In contrast to this common approach, they point out the many deficiencies of this type of detached professionalism. In this book, we are going to argue that the opposite is true. Most organizations, we believe, have become depersonalized to the point where energy levels are low, cynicism is high, and work fails to fulfill or excite. Our observation is that committed employees perform many times more efficiently than apathetic ones do, and this is even more true for teams. As many leadership thinkers have noted, an energized team doesn't just perform a little bit better, but exponentially better, 10 or even 50 times better. And recent research is showing even more the importance of emotional intelligence and social intelligence in the workplace, not just hard skills. And so I would argue that professionalism in this sense, the sense that Piper is talking about and critiquing, is not only killing the ministry, it is killing the business world. Rejecting this detached type of professionalism gets us unstuck from wrong ways of thinking about work and helps us see that being human in our work is not a drawback, but an asset. We are to be our whole selves everywhere. The best workers, if you think of it, are actually the most human. Tim Sanders lays out the business case for this argument in his classic book, Love is the Killer App. He describes love as the point of differentiation in business. The old, bad form of professionalism even taught a rigid distinction between personal and professional lives. "Don't develop friends on the job. If you need friends, join a bowling club," it counseled. But we spend more time working than doing anything else. How miserable it would be not to see work as an arena where we can develop friendships. In fact, some of the best friendships can be built in the workplace because you have a common cause. And, as much research has shown, friendships in the workplace actually increase performance. The ethic of a true professional. We are seeing something here that helps us round out our definition of professional. A professional is not only someone who delivers great results over and over again. A professional is also someone who has a certain ethic. And this ethic includes emotional intelligence. Being a professional means working with consistency and having a certain ethic, an ethic of emotional involvement and generosity, and being human in your work. Here are five components that are part of a professional ethic in the fullest sense. Passion. Passion is the element of emotional involvement in your work. You care about your work and the people you are doing it for. Your work becomes, as Seth Godin puts it, emotional labor. John Piper summarizes this concept well in his interview, 10 Principles for Personal Productivity. Kill half-heartedness. Do what you do with all your heart. Be done with half-heartedness. Oh, so many people limp through life doing what they do with a half heart, with half of their energy. If it is worth doing, it is worth doing with your whole soul. Ecclesiastes 9 verse 10 says, "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might." Jonathan Edwards' resolution probably had more impact on me in the last 30 years than anything else he said, in his resolutions at least, when he said, "Resolved to live with all my might while I do live." Resolution number 6. Those words took hold of me a long time ago. I thought, "Oh, yes, Lord." Some people downplay the importance of enjoying our work, but it matters. It can't be the only consideration, but it is an important one. I have heard it over and over again from effective people that one of their keys to success is enjoying their work, because without that, they wouldn't have the fuel to persist. The value of enjoying our work is also backed by research. From the Gallup Organization's research on strengths, to Jerry Porras and his co-author's research for the book Success Built to Last, on what leads to holistic success. They have an entire chapter on why it's dangerous not to love your work. This is not a pie-in-the-sky notion, but a necessity for effectiveness. You will do better work when you enjoy it most of the time. Joyfully doing hard things. Many hard tasks are motivating and enjoyable. And even the ones that aren't enjoyable have a place. To say we should enjoy our work does not mean that the only things we do in our work will be things we enjoy. We are more effective, Marcus Buckingham points out, when we are in our strengths, doing things that energize us and at which we excel most of the time during our day. But of course, there will be times we are not, and that's okay, and even essential. The key is to keep tasks in balance. Piper captures this well. Joyfully embrace hard tasks. Be willing to do many things in life cheerfully that at first you don't want to do. They don't come naturally to you. There is no worthwhile role in life that does not require you to do things you don't at first feel like doing, or that only let you do what comes naturally. So be cheerful in doing the parts of your life that you do not at first prefer to do. Remarkability. The era of average stuff is over. Being remarkable means providing goods and services that stand out, that are worth remarking on, that get people excited. Being remarkable is good for business too, because it gets people talking, which is the most effective form of marketing, and is free. A lot of times, when people think of Christian work, they think only of ethics. Rock-solid ethics are, of course, central, and a part of most professional codes as well. They should never be compromised. But ethics are not the sum of what God requires. He calls us to go beyond moral work to righteous work. Work that inspires and delights like His work does. More than functional, it is beautiful, and people connect emotionally with it. Christian work requires passion and a sense of beauty and love, for ethics alone can be selfish and even used to the detriment of others, such as when people mindlessly enforce rules that actually harm people rather than thinking things through and finding a better way. I have seen people who are ethical in their work but don't lift a finger to help others. Such behavior is not generous and not the full ethic God requires. Why is the flourishing of the righteous a cause for rejoicing? Proverbs 11, verse 10. It's not just because they are ethical. It's because they are good. They don't just avoid breaking certain codes, as important as that is. They bring their humanity to work and do things that truly benefit and delight people. Recognizing the centrality of good design. Essential to being remarkable is recognizing the centrality of good design. Good design is not just product packaging, but everything the customer experiences from start to finish. It means the promotion is beautiful, the product or service is beautiful, and the way of acquiring it is beautiful. And design extends even beyond products and services to systems. The systems, policies, and principles of an organization are to be beautiful and to embody good design as well. Good design is fundamental because God created us as whole people, as emotional as well as functional. Good design connects especially with the emotional side of people and creates an emotional connection with the brand. Hence, it is a component of effectiveness as well as the right thing to do. And executing good design is everybody's job, not just the designers. Generosity. Generosity is the new model of working. Generous people are uplifting and encouraging to others. They are also always sharing with coworkers and with their customers. With their coworkers, they share their knowledge, network, and compassion, seeking to help others succeed just as much as they are seeking to succeed themselves. And with customers, they avoid having an adversarial mindset, or even a merely transactional one, and seek not just to earn revenue from them, but to truly serve them and build them up. This involves putting the needs of customers ahead of their own. So often, when there is a conflict between the desires of corporate leadership and the needs of the customer, the company wins. This is one reason some websites are hard to use. Making a website more user-friendly takes a bit more time and requires seeing from the customer's viewpoint. Therefore, many organizations take shortcuts. But a generous ethic says, the purpose of a business is to serve the customer, so I am willing to make things harder for myself in order to make things easier for my customers. I will take the extra time to make this website or other product easier to use, so that my customers can have a more pleasant experience. This principle of generosity applies even in sports. Football coach Bill Belichick points out that in sports, generosity is what makes great players great. I think great players help other players play better, and I think that's what makes them great players. There are a lot of players that go out there and play very well, and they add a lot to your team. There are certain players that help their teammates play better. Those guys are special. Because it's not just what they do, it's the uplifting of the players around them. Generosity is not just good for others, it is also good for you. People want to do business with those who are generous. As many have pointed out, generosity creates a powerful personal brand. Keith Ferrazzi says it well. Remember, it's easier to get ahead in the world when those below you are happy to help you get ahead, rather than hoping for your downfall. In sum, loving your neighbor as yourself is the way to success in work. Instituting pro-people policies. Finally, it's not just people and employees and managers who should be generous and human. Companies should be too. This means instituting pro-people policies. It means having human systems rather than bureaucratic systems. Systems that encourage doing good rather than creating red tape. For example, some churches require that homeless people asking for assistance fill out forms. Why? To ensure that the person has a real need and that the church is stewarding their resources well. But what does that say about the homeless person's need? That it can wait. But this is not like waiting in line for a new iPhone. Homeless people have essential needs. Nevertheless, they are made to wait while the forms are processed. If we go to the Apple store to buy an iPhone, except in an extreme circumstance, it's going to be there because they care about selling it to us. And a phone is just a convenience. Why then are we okay with making the homeless wait until the benevolence committee can meet? What if Apple sold iPhones that way? We'd say they are not customer-oriented. So is the church people-oriented when they make the homeless wait for help? Sometimes, policies that can seem reasonable because they appear to steward the resources of the organization well, do so at the expense of compassion and genuine humanity. This is just one example, and perhaps an extreme one at that. The point is that organizations need to think about the impact their policies will have on employees and others, and seek to make it a beneficial impact that will encourage and uplift and motivate, not just make sure it meets the organization's own needs. And, interestingly, often that which best serves the employees and customers also benefits the organization most. Thinking win-win rather than win-I-don't-care or win-lose is usually an advantage to both parties. The Unstuck Clinic. Core point. Reject professionalism in the bad sense of detachment and distance. Embrace it in the good sense of doing great work, even when you don't feel like it, bringing an ethic of generosity and humanity to your work. Exercise. Have you ever experienced resistance? How have you dealt with it? What has worked and what hasn't? Write your thoughts down. Chapter 10. Preparation. Get the knowledge you need. Why preparation is so essential, and new evidence from neuroscience on why it works. Desire without knowledge is not good, and whoever makes haste with his feet misses his way. Proverbs 19, verse 2. I've seen a lot of bloggers say things like, "You already know all that you need to know, you just have to get going." Is that true? Their point is that we should not get caught up in trying to be perfectly prepared and in making everything perfect, and that is good. But we are taking that too far if we assume that we always already know what we need to know, for sometimes we don't. And if we don't take the time to prepare and get the knowledge we need, we will not succeed. In fact, even if we know how to manage our time well, we will still not be effective unless we also know how to do the content skills of our work well. This is the other side of the coin. I have emphasized how content skills are not by themselves enough, since you also have to have the underlying skill of personal effectiveness to enable you to use those content skills well. It is also the case, however, that without the content skills, your time management is not going to be effective either. And so, we must prepare and get the knowledge we need. This is especially true today, since the economy keeps demanding new skills of us. We need to be able to learn new skills and prepare quickly, so that we aren't spending all our time preparing. I experienced this when I first started writing books. I knew how to manage my time and had written hundreds of articles and blog posts. Writing came quickly to me. But when I sat down to write my first book, I got stuck. The words would not come. What was the problem? Writing books, it turned out, was very different from writing articles. A book is not just a long article, it is something entirely different. I did not yet have the skill of writing books, as opposed to articles and blog posts, mastered. Thus, my time management skills were not of much help to me. Sometimes I would spend the large chunks of time I had blocked off just staring at the screen, trying to figure out what to say. Other times, I would take the advice to just write anything and end up writing so much that it was almost too much to manage. And unfortunately, most of the chapters I wrote following that advice were not needed in the final book. As I began to grow in my skill of writing books, I started to be able to do it faster and more efficiently. It took time, but it did start to come. Developing the skill to do the tasks of your work is an essential yet often overlooked key to getting unstuck. Part of getting unstuck, in other words, is developing the capacity to achieve. Why did Rudy Giuliani lead so well after September 11th? The most effective leaders have discovered the crucial role preparation plays in getting unstuck. Rudy Giuliani, one of the most effective mayors of New York City in recent decades, who brought crime levels down and is admired for his leadership after 9/11, writes in his book Leadership, "Preparation is the single most important key to success, no matter what the field." He continues, "Leaders may possess brilliance, extraordinary vision, fate, even luck. Those help. But no one, no matter how gifted, can perform without careful preparation, thoughtful experiment, and determined follow-through." Giuliani speaks of the crucial role preparation played in enabling him to lead effectively after September 11th. He had actually been working on his book on leadership in the months preceding 9/11, so all of the leadership lessons he needed were fresh in his mind. He writes, "By September 11, I had been working on the book for months. It had become almost a seminar for me, a self-imposed program on how to run an organization. It was as if God had provided an opportunity to design a course in leadership just when I needed it most. By the time of the horrible events of September 11, because of all that I'd been working on, the elements were fresh in my mind, which gave me confidence." Then he adds, "Every single principle that follows in the book was summoned within hours of the attack on the World Trade Center." Preparation is what sets apart those who want to succeed from those who actually do. The great basketball coach Bobby Knight noted, "Everyone has the will to win, but it's only those with the will to prepare that do win." Likewise, Tim Sanders says, "The best prepared will always win. To be the best prepared, you need to do some things that aren't necessarily fun or easy." Why we need to prepare? Four reasons. Preparation allows tasks to require less effort. Earlier, we learned about the skill-will matrix, which showed us that success is not simply a function of desire, but also ability. Proverbs 19, verse 2, teaches the same thing. "Desire without knowledge is not good, and whoever makes haste with his feet misses his way." Not to prepare, not to get the knowledge you need, is hasty, and simply having desire without ability will not allow you to succeed. Preparation is the building up of your abilities. It helps you understand a situation better and develop your skills so they are ready for action. You will be able to envision more effective approaches and, as a result, use less energy. As Ecclesiastes 10 verse 10 says, "If the iron is blunt and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength, but wisdom, skill, helps one to succeed." Higher skill for a task means the task will take less effort. Preparation connects with the principle we saw earlier of the need to value production as well as production capacity. Preparation increases your ability to produce. Preparation enables you to adapt and be resilient. Tim Sanders writes that great preparation makes you resilient when faced with adversity and proactive when shown opportunity. You are resilient because you are ready for many different possibilities. Planning is one type of preparation. Some people have said planning is not worth it because nothing goes according to plan. But that idea misses the point of planning. The main goal is not the plan itself, as though it has to be perfectly followed. It can't be, since circumstances always change. The main value is what planning does for your mind. It prepares you. As Dwight Eisenhower once said, "In preparing for battle, I have always found that plans are useless, but planning is indispensable." Preparation is part of continual learning. Leaders are always learning. As leadership expert John Cotter has observed, the most notable trait of great leaders is their quest for learning. Churchill embodied this trait, with one of his biographers noting that Churchill was relentless in his drive for mastery of affairs. Willie Peterson, one of the best authors on strategy, writes, "You should never stop learning. Unfortunately, many promising managers derail their careers when they stop striving for self-improvement, either because they think they've learned all there is to know, or because they fail to translate their learning into meaningful leadership development." This is especially true today because the environment keeps changing. We need to learn our jobs really well and then keep learning, because information flows in too many directions, knowledge is fleeting, and power can be perilous. The ability to learn is now just as critical, often more critical, as what you know. This truth holds for organizations also. Knowledge is the underlying lifeblood of business in the 21st century. The Dutch business executive Eri de Hoos says, "The ability to learn faster than your competitors may be the only sustainable competitive advantage." Success brings new challenges. Not only does the environment constantly bring new challenges, but success itself brings new challenges. In other words, as you succeed, success brings its own new potentials for getting stuck. So you need to always keep learning and always keep preparing. As David Allen says, "Just when you learn how to enhance your productivity and decision-making at one level, you'll graduate to the next accepted batch of responsibilities and creative goals, whose new challenges will defy the ability of any simple formula." Why preparation works. Understanding not just that we need to prepare, but also why preparation works is crucial. For knowing why it works actually helps us prepare better, as well as motivates us to do it. The primary thing I mean by preparation right now, though we will see more aspects of it soon, is becoming really good at your job, achieving mastery at what you do through experience, practice, and accumulating knowledge. Here's why this is so powerful. When you become really good at something, more aspects of it move to autopilot. And that is valuable because actions on autopilot save you mental energy. For tasks done on autopilot don't use up our stockpile of energy like tasks that have to be consciously completed. Your mental energy is freed up to focus on greater challenges, thus enabling greater expertise. In other words, when you are really good at your work, more is ingrained in the hard drive of your mind rather than in your very limited and energy-consuming short-term memory. That's why you can do more and do it better. Daniel Goleman describes this very well in his excellent book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence, showing how the brain science works. In short, we have a top system, which requires a lot of energy and is for less familiar things, requiring more conscious focus, and a bottom system, which requires less energy and works a lot like autopilot. The bottom-top systems distribute mental tasks between them, so we can make minimal effort and get optimal results. As familiarity makes a routine easier, it gets passed off from the top to the bottom. The way we experience this neural transfer is that we need pay less attention, and finally, none, as it becomes automatic. The peak of automaticity can be seen when expertise pays off an effortless attention to high demand, whether a master-level chess match, a NASCAR race, or rendering an oil painting. If we haven't practiced enough, all of these will take deliberate focus. But if we have mastered the requisite skills to a level that meets the demand, they will take no extra cognitive effort, freeing our attention for the extra seen only among those at top levels. In other words, as you practice and prepare, less of the routine and standard aspects of your tasks will take deliberate focus. This allows you to give deliberate focus to the things that really set you apart and create excellence, which is the mark of high performers. The more you can relax and trust in bottom-up moves, the more you free your mind to be nimble. Martin Seligman explains this concept well in Flourish. Any complex mental task has fast automatic components and slower voluntary components that take much more effort. The more components of a task you have on automatic, the more time you have left over to do the heavy lifting. This is crucial because what distinguishes a great surgeon or a great pilot from the rest